Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. 2018 gubernatorial candidate Billy Sutton has announced a new bipartisan leadership program, and Pennington County State's Attorney says he won't prosecute those CBD oil cases. Those are just two of the topics in front of the Dakota Political Junkies. We're joined today by Jonathan Ellis, investigative reporter and columnist for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
And in the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City, it's Rapid City Journal Enterprise reporter Seth Tupper. Seth, good to see you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And we get to talk about CBD oil and Paul Erickson, and I know these topics are just two of your favorites. So it's a good day on the Dakota Political Junkies. And Jonathan, let's start with you, because the last time you were on the program, we were going back and forth about this sort of confusion about CBD and whether or not things would be prosecuted. Now we're seeing some folks step out and say, not so much, which contradicts what the South Dakota Attorney General has to say.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we talked about this before. The Attorney General said, hey, CBD stuff, hemp is illegal in South Dakota. I think you guys actually reported that a man from Alaska was arrested in Sioux Falls for having a CBD oil and charged. I don't know what the outcome of that was. I think, and then, of course, our friends Seth and at the Rapid City Journal, they reported then that the Pennington County State's Attorney is not going to be prosecuted. So everything seems to be a little bit in disarray. And I think the Rapid City Journal's reporting indicated that, you know, that they don't know that they could necessarily get a conviction. There's just a lot of confusion. I've had interactions with a few people who thought that Senate Bill 22 in the last legislative session was supposed to actually take CBD oil off, and then it turns out that it's only one product that has actually been FDA approved. If you read, there are a couple places in South Dakota's laws where it spells out that, and very poorly written laws, that if you read them, you are left with the impression that anything that has not been approved by the FDA that's any kind of derivative of cannabis, which hemp is illegal. And again, I've had to, the one law in particular, I've had to read it, you know, several times to actually get the gist of what it was saying. But I think then that that's also what the Attorney General's office is basing its opinions off of.
Hmm. All right. So it's important for us to note, as this gets confusing, that what is not confusing is that the prescription Epidiolex is legal. You need a prescription for it. But the folks who are using that are absolutely doing, obeying the law. And there's a lot of other stuff on the outside that people are a little confused about. Seth, what do you want to add to sort of the conversation about the significance of the state's attorney from Pennington County saying, you know, we don't think we can get a conviction?
Well, I'm going to give a shout out first to Ariel Zients. She's a reporter who broke that story. And, you know, I don't know, Mark Vargo, our state's attorney here, he's always struck me as a pretty practical guy, and I don't know if he would say this, but I mean, I'm sure that one of the considerations here probably is that law enforcement have better things to do than arrest people for, you know, rubbing a harmless cream on their joints or whatever, you know, just to cure their arthritis or something, you know.
Not in Sioux Falls, so.
Well, yeah, that's true. And of course, there are legal, you know, there's an important legal analysis to be made, but there's also practical, you know, analysis to be done. And I think that probably has been part of it. The other thing, though, is that, you know, I think one thing that's being left out of the conversation is, you know, federally, you could still get in trouble for this stuff, as I understand it. And we know now that we all have our own understanding of these laws, and it's, they're all different, everybody's understanding. But you still need, if any of these products are sold under claims of improving somebody's health or well-being, that still needs FDA approval. And if you don't have that, that could still be illegal. So, I mean, right. it's a giant mess, but I think it, we need our legislators at some point to step in and clear some of this stuff up with by simplifying things.
And, you know, I was a little flippant there about not in Sioux Falls, and I didn't mean that as, you know, anything other than, and I think, Jonathan, you alluded to this with Lee Strubinger's coverage on SDPB of this topic, is that this man from Alaska is charged with a felony. And that has, so if in Minnehaha County that is prosecuted and he is convicted, that's a pretty serious, a serious conviction that can follow you for the rest of your life, being convicted of a felony. That's where we left it last week, which was a lot of people want to say, hey, cops have better things to do. But watch out, because there is confusion right now, and that can change your life. That confusion can.
Well, I mean, a felony conviction, I think, would preclude you then from owning firearms or going hunting, or So I mean, it's nothing to laugh about. I mean, that's a very serious conviction.
And if he's from, I don't know this man. If he's from Alaska, the expense alone of trying to figure out how to defend yourself at this point is another increased challenge.
Yeah, you're right. He would have to come back for court trials, get a lawyer, all of that good stuff. I had to put my phone on mute when Seth mentioned that that the Pennington County State Attorney might have other practical reasons, that the police might have other things better to do, and I did have to laugh because you think.
So you can find that story on RapidCityJournal.com, and that's Ariel Zients. Is that how you say it?
Ariel Zients.
Ariel Zients did the work on that, so look that up at RapidCityJournal.com. And now another article from that newspaper from Seth Tupper is about an update as court documents are released regarding Paul Erickson. And Seth, I tell you what, if you're not subscribing to the Rapid City Journal yet, I don't know why, because just the lead of this story, I want to read out loud, because it says, previously secret court documents that were unsealed Monday paint a portrait of rampant, lucrative, brazen, and long-lasting fraud allegedly committed against both high and low-profile victims by Paul Erickson, the South Dakota man whose Russian girlfriend has pleaded guilty to illegally acting as a foreign agent for her home country. Jonathan, isn't that just a wonderful lead for a newspaper? He packed a lot into that sentence.
I wish I had written that.
I wish I had written it too.
It got a little long though. But it,
you have a lot to get people caught up on, and I'm being serious at the quality of the writing and this reporting that you have done. So tell us a little bit about what's new in this case, because documents have been unsealed.
Well. Just when you thought this case couldn't get any more bizarre, so I've been watching for these documents for a long time. Back when this story broke long ago, it was clear that Paul Erickson's apartment and his girlfriend Maria Bettina's apartment, his in Sioux Falls, hers in D.C., had been searched, but none of the search warrants were public or anything. On Monday, the affidavit that was filed in support of the search warrant request for Erickson's apartment back last April. Was finally unsealed, and it had a lot of details in it. And lo and behold, it has a lot of the names of the people who were allegedly victimized by Paul Erickson's investment schemes. And one of them was Mark Sanford. And you're thinking, Mark Sanford, isn't that? Yeah, it's that Mark Sanford, the guy who was governor of South Carolina and went missing, claimed he was hiking the Appalachian Trail and was actually having an extramarital affair in Argentina. And so he invested at least $25,000 with Erickson, later apparently got that money back. And then there were other interesting names in there, which you can check out either in my story or in the document itself that I posted with the story online. And of course, also the amount was interesting. When Erickson was indicted, they included about $1 million worth of fraud that they thought he had committed. It added up to in the indictment. In this affidavit that was filed for the search warrant, what they're totaling up there adds up to $2.3 million over the course of 20 some odd years.
And it seems to me, as I was reading through this, a connection tangentially, of course, to the college cheating scandal, when all of a sudden the veil is pulled back a little bit and people are really drawn into the story because it has these sort of, wild connections and a lot of money that's moving back and forth that is essentially, for nothing. You start asking, why would someone pay that much, money for something that really, the promise was too good to be true in the first place. Do you think that's one of the things, Seth, that's been so appealing to this as a, for readers to just see the web that exists underneath, the initial story?
That is a good comparison because, as you've seen, quite a few of the people who invested with Erickson and apparently lost their money, most of them, were people that were highly placed in society, people of means, people that one might think would know better than to invest with a guy like this, but they did. And that was his MO, as he sidled up to these people allegedly. And I've seen his fundraising letters where he often said this is an exclusive opportunity only for friends and family, and there was a sense of urgency. And you know, those of us, you and I and Jonathan, I think we do. I don't know about you guys, but I'm not often offered investment opportunities like that. But there's a different people who exist in a different sphere who are offered opportunities like that. And obviously, right. They bite at them sometimes, and sometimes they work, and sometimes you get allegedly swindled by Paul Erickson,
which is why he targeted them exactly for that reason. He knew what he was doing. Jonathan,
allegedly.
Yeah, allegedly. He allegedly knew what he was allegedly doing. Jonathan, any thoughts on this as it continues to unfold?
Yeah, it's interesting. You would have thought, especially in Mark Sanford would be one of the guys who is surprising to me, because Brent Bilzel, the third, got a judgment against Erickson as far back as, I think it was in 2006 now, alleging that he'd been swindled out of, I think it was $100,000 on one of these investment schemes. Now, Bazell is sort of like conservative, I mean, royalty within the sort of intellectual conservative movement. He had ties. His father was a contemporary of William F. Buckley, and they had ties with this sort of the elite of this movement. And you would have thought then that the word would have kind of gotten out, at least in some of these circles, that what Erickson was allegedly doing is scamming people. And so I'm just surprised that he was able to kind of carry this on for as long as he has. Again, allegedly. I mean, nothing's been proven guilty here. But so it's interesting. It is a fascinating story as it unfolds.
Right. And the name listed as Brent Bozell in the affidavit is also potential, because we're not 100% sure that's the same person. Is that right, Seth?
Yeah, I haven't gotten prosecutors to tell me for sure on that. They won't talk about it. And Bozell, I've called him numerous times, and he's never called me back. But yeah, as Jonathan said, this Brent Bozell, who's oftentimes a commentator on Fox, he's sued Erickson in the past for for exactly the type of things that Erickson's accused of now criminally. But for whatever reason, when these documents came out Monday, it listed a Brett Bozell instead of a Brent Bozell. And I have to assume maybe they're one and the same, but I don't know.
But some good, careful journalism there. Read that on rapidcityjournal.com. Let's talk a little bit about Billy Sutton, because his name has emerged, and it's not regarding the 2020 election. It is regarding a new bipartisan leadership program. Jonathan, take a swing at what's going on here.
The Billy Sutton Leadership Institute, kind of an interesting deal, and it has roots to what Tom Daschle used to do as well. But it sounds like what they're going to be doing is people who are interested in maybe some public policy, being involved. It sounds like learning some skills about being involved in public life. Billy obviously ran a very good campaign for governor. This sort of harkens back to what Tom Daschle did over the course of his career. He had sort of the Daschle leadership camps, in which they would, there would be conferences, and there'd be opportunities to learn how to be a candidate for public office or to be involved in public life. And Daschle was pretty successful grooming sort of a new generation of Democratic leaders who went on to run for local offices, legislature, things like that. So this sounds like it's very similar to what Daschle had done. Curiously, one of the graduates or one of the attendees of one of the Daschle camps way back, I think probably in the late 90s, was none other than Kristi Noem, who went on, obviously, to win a congressional seat. So what Billy is doing, it sounds a lot like what Tom Daschle did a couple decades ago.
All right, and so we had Dan Lederman, who was chair of the Republican State Party, on earlier in the program, and he talked about the organization of the Republican Party and how tight that organization is, how daily communication goes back and forth. Seth, talk a little bit about the sort of effort of Sutton to invest in the leaders and the public servants of the future. Is it tie into this notion of really organization and communication and creating a pipeline?
Well, it's interesting to me that he seems to be doing it outside of the party. Right. There's also, besides the Daschle effort that Jonathan mentioned, there's a corollary here with the Teenage Republicans, which is a Republican effort, which Dusty Johnson, you know, ran for a long time and was one of the many things that he helped sort of build his profile as he finally ran for U.S. House and won. And so to me, it's interesting. I don't know, you know, I haven't talked to Billy Sutton about this, but I have to wonder if there's an element here where the Democratic Party isn't organized enough and the organization isn't consistent enough between elections to rely on the party to do something like this, like what Billy's doing. So maybe he felt he had to do it himself. Mm-hmm. And that might be a reflection of the what we know is, you know, the difference between the sort of the consistent organized structure of the Republican Party in South Dakota that is really sort of a steady hand for the party between elections and that how that contrasts with the Democratic Party, which because of numbers and so many other factors, you know, isn't as steady as, and a consistent presence for Democrats as the party structure is for Republicans.
All right. And former Senator Billy Sutton joins in the moment tomorrow at noon as well. We'll ask him more about that leadership program. And let's close with the flaming fountains of Peer, because they're not quite as flaming as some people would like. Seth, you wrote about this. Give us an overview of what went wrong with the eternal flame.
Yeah, so this is funny. I was at the I went to the West River Hydrology Conference last week, and I was listening to a presentation
<course you did.
laughs> by this guy, Dan Soder, at the School of Mines, who was talking about monitoring natural gas wells for leaks. And he just, as a small part of his presentation, he mentioned that they just installed this device at the Flaming Fountain at the Capitol and Pier to monitor the amount of natural gas in the air around the fountain. And so I asked him more questions about that and developed it into a story. And I guess it's been written before in other places that the Flaming Fountain hasn't been flaming for quite a few years or flaming consistently. But now it appears some action has been taken to try to do something about it. Last session, pretty quietly, a bill passed to authorize up to a couple $100,000 in fundraising to try to figure out, you know, exactly what's going on and get it fixed. And the School of Mines is involved right now in monitoring the fountain. But the basic setup of the fountain was in the early 1900s, a well was drilled, an artesian water well, but natural gas also came up with it. And so, you know, long story short, they just set the gas on fire as it emerged with the water, and that's how the Flaming Fountain was born. It's always burned up until, you know, at least maybe 2008 or a little earlier. It started to be inconsistent, and now they can't seem to keep it lit because apparently not enough gas is coming out or it's inconsistent, and that's what they're trying to figure out.
Mm. But Jonathan, there's a little bit of a, you know, sort of confusion about where it began, because a lot of people consider this as part of a tribute to veterans.
I mean, and this is a great historical, I mean, if you're interested in the history, I love this story that, you know, from Seth. I mean, who dug the well, the original well? I mean, that's a really cool historical fact by itself, Seth.
Yeah, Peter Norbeck, former governor right. and U.S. senator. Yeah,
I had forgotten that. Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah. and Seth, now, is it been integrated into the, you know, honoring of veterans there in sort of the architecture, the monuments of? So it wasn't originally a tribute to South Dakota veterans, but it is now because of, you know, they kind of said it was.
Yeah, it was just it was for practical purposes. Originally, they drilled it to fill Capitol Lake, which is man-made, and also to siphon off some of the natural gas to light and heat the Capitol. Yeah. And over the years, in the 1950s, there was actually an explosion near the Capitol because of some leaking gas. And so they capped off the gas lines, but there was still so much gas coming out of the fountain, they thought that could be potentially dangerous. So somebody came up with a great idea, we'll just light it on fire. And it became basically a natural gas flare that was just sort of a curiosity for quite a few years until in the 70s and 80s, there was this movement to build these war memorials, and they built them around the fountain, and that's how the fountain came to be. Basically viewed as part of these memorials, and it is today, but originally it never was.
So that kind of makes it hard to go back to just a fountain.
Exactly. So now we've kind of painted ourselves in a corner where
that's
we feel
what
like
I'm getting
we have
at
to
there.
Fix
yeah.
this thing. Yeah.
Now that you've said it is something that it wasn't originally, now you have to maintain it and pay attention to it in a different way than maybe you would have if it was just a bubbling fountain.
Exactly.
A little bit of an update on some of the efforts to talk about voting rights in the Native American community as well. That's making a lot of news. And Jonathan, what exactly is kind of going on there from a South Dakota perspective?
Well, South Dakota, I mean, it was you had a congressional hearing in Standing Rock, which obviously is part of in South Dakota as well as North Dakota. And there have been, I think the congressional hearing, field hearing, focused on, I think, mainly what North Dakota had in terms of their, new voting requirements that required people to actually have a physical, I think, street address on their ID in order to vote, as opposed to a P.O. box, which Native American groups say that it's very puts a big burden on tribal residents who often have P.O. boxes and don't necessarily have an official street address. So that the field hearing and Democrats took control of the House in the last election, and so they're very interested in exploring these issues. So this was the House field hearing in Standing Rock, and of course, South Dakota is no stranger to reservation voting rights issues. I mean, we've had several lawsuits over the years filed, and the Justice Department concluding that, at least I think in 2000, that the legislature had sort of created districts that were sort of packed Native Americans into certain districts. And this is just over the years in South Dakota and also North Dakota, have been a longstanding issue of whether or not Native Americans have been getting sort of the opportunities to vote that others get.
Hmm. Seth, anything you want to add in this conversation?
Well, there are concrete examples of this, and it is sad. And there's a lot of people, some in Rapid City, who would tell you we have a legislative district here, District 33, that's very oddly and irregularly shaped. It swoops around West Rapid, picks up a lot of the more affluent, whiter neighborhoods there, and then comes around to the north and dips down into North Rapid, where there's a higher Native American population, and sort of picks up some of those folks and therefore dilutes the Native American vote. Splitting it between two districts. And there are stories like that that sort of abound in South Dakota, and I think it is something that is definitely needs more attention.
Hmm. Seth Toffber with the Rapid City Journal. Find his work at rapidcityjournal.com. Seth, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Ellis, argusleader.com is where you can find his work, and definitely follow him on Twitter. Jonathan, thanks so much for being here as well.
Yeah, thanks, Lori.